On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. John Climo discusses his 30-plus years of research into channeling and other unexplained aspects of human consciousness.
This is positive psychology, really, where we learn from not the damaged goods of our fellow beings, but from them on a very good hair day of being a human being, and see, gee, could I go there? Could I have a little better quality of life? Could I be a little smarter? Could I be a little more self-fulfilled? And of course you can. So I focused at Rutgers those 8 years in how to make accessible these realms that could, in the extreme, be considered off-putting or threatening, because you begin to then label them as psychism or metaphysics, or, you know, don't be so open-minded your brains fall out, and I'm not going to let that happen, so you stay more tightly wrapped.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have what turned out for me to be a very, very interesting discussion with Dr. John Climo, and I'm going to get to that in 1 minute, but I just wanted to take a second and thank all of you who have connected with me and offered your help and support in the research projects that we're working on. And at the same time, I'd like to encourage more of that. So if any of you are interested in helping really dig into this research and formulate these projects and figure out how to most effectively communicate this research to other people, please drop me an email. Let me know who you are, what you do, and how you think you might want to get involved. Well, with that, this is a rather long interview with Dr. Climo, so I'm going to move right into it. Hope you enjoy it, and please stay in touch.
I took a stroll on the old long walk of the day. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk of a fine soft day. And I asked a friend, what's a fella to do? Cause her hair is black and her eyes are blue.
Our guest today is professor of clinical psychology at Argos University in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's an expert on channeling and mediumship, having authored Channeling, Investigations on Receiving Information from Paranormal Source, which is more or less the definitive book on the topic. Dr. John Climo is also an artist and a poet, a real Renaissance man who's not afraid to speak out on what he's discovered in 30-plus years of research in this topic. So, Dr. Climo, welcome to Skeptico.
Thank you.
I ran across your website and I was fascinated. I really got to say, you're brave. You are brave. And I think that comes through. You've thought deeply about this subject from a number of different perspectives, and we want to get into that. A good place to start, at least for me, is you do bring quite an interesting and diverse background to this area of inquiry that you've gotten into, or that you're best known for, that is channeling and mediumship. Can you give us maybe a brief sketch of your bio and maybe along the way define, as you are using the term, channeling, and how you became interested in that, both intellectually and scientifically? There, now I've kind of teed up probably an hour's worth of topic right there, but give it your best.
Sure. And at the same time, we're talking about channeling. I see that as an entry point, almost like a Rosetta Stone, that if you can understand that anomalous domain, you can understand an awful lot of other anomalous or currently inexplicable domains that are kind of portals to mm-hmm. advancing our scientific and even our spiritual understanding and being in the world. So for me, I'm not overly attached to channeling per se, other than that it is terribly useful because it gets you into consciousness and higher dimensionality and non-physical realms and pushing the edges of science on a number of different discipline fronts. So in that sense, sure, I like to talk about channeling. At the same time, that's a starting point for talk about a number of other things that I'm also interested in talking about and that I'm doing a lot of work in, but we can see whether we get to any of them or not. So how did I...
You know, I would just interject there because I think that it's one of the challenges that we all face when we talk about any of these subjects is our vocabulary is so limited. And I think it's kind of a recursive kind of dialogue. But why is our vocabulary limited? Well, we haven't intellectually and scientifically addressed these areas enough. Well, why haven't we addressed them enough? And then it just kind of gets back on the same thing. 'Cause
then you're into the politics behind it that, you know, show me more data, show me more research, you know, get my attention, maintain it, earn the right for me to sit here and break bread with you together, so to speak. And then one feels on my end of it, or people like myself, we kind of go limp with frustration inside because we are kept from the table. We're kept from the funding. We're kept from the jobs. We're kept from the conferences. We can't do lunch in that town with other people who are, you know, part of the priestly knowledge. And so it's frustrating. It's like, no, we're not going to support that or take it seriously, but at the same time, show me the same kind of evidence and system of argument and so on that we have in our other scientific areas. Because, you know, parapsychology is one of the member sciences of the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences, and they wish they could take away that invitation, but it was hard-earned. Right. And yes.
So then there's so many thoughts that spring to mind when you say all that, but before we jump into that, take us back a little bit, because was it a choice that you made academically in your career to go in this area? And if so, did you foresee some of the challenges that you were just kind of talking about there?
Well, I began this life as a poet and an artist, as a creative person, which is kind of a bohemian outsider, as Colin Wilson would call it in his book. I satisfy the definition of being more of an outsider. I don't sit in the center of academia and the scientific and intelligentsia community, or mm-hmm. not until recent decades. But mm-hmm. when I began, I was far from it. It had nothing to do with teaching or research or anything like that. It began as a creative person, and after a while, after years of doing this, starting really as a very, very early adolescence or late childhood, being involved with the creative process, intuition, inspiration, imagination, kind of a self-transcending process. And I would come up for air after these episodes, these kind of often unbidden episodes of I guess you could call extreme inspiration, mm-hmm. and kind of a self-transcending quality to them as I experienced mm-hmm. them phenomenologically. I'd come back from these bouts, and I'd say, what was that all about? Was that me? Where did I go? Was I out of body? Did I stop being me and somebody else was there? Was I overshadowed by larger me? Did I go out of normal limited me and into a larger me? Does it transcend all me's? And there's some impersonal, kind of a ground that I entered into that gave me the images and the words and the lyrical impulses and qualities that I could then drink from and bring back and encode as a poet or as a painter. Well, that's the gist I wanted to get across, was that I began, how did you get involved with channeling? I became involved with channeling as a creative person. In my channeling book, I call it open channeling, for lack of a better term, meaning it's what I would call entity-less channeling. You don't lose control or consciousness or step aside. I began kind of surrendering or giving myself over to some kind of self-transcending larger presence and locus or a source of information, energy, guidance, ideation, mentation, energy, even healing energy it could be. And that was all available to me. And the only place I had to put it as a frame of reference was the arts and creativity, the poet. So from like Emerson wrote a long essay on the poet, which I very much identify with. And Seth, the channeled entity, refers to Emerson as being what Seth calls a speaker, and that poets are sort of speakers. So I just gave a conference this weekend about that. So that for me, a poet, being a poet with a capital P, was always a kind of a form of being a channel, I would say, because it was self-transcending. Something seemed to come from beyond, I'm giving a definition now, something seemed to be coming from beyond me, beyond my normal ego, my normal skin encapsulated ego, my own normal lived experience, my normal realm of competency and abilities. And it came to or through me, and then I would just sort of ride it bareback and try to capture as much as I could to witness it and to symbolize it and encode it, to make it communicable and share with others, to make that private more public. And I've done that really all my life, and it began as an artist and a poet, and it's been that way ever since.
Okay, yeah, I was afraid that this was going to happen. You have in probably 5 or 10 minutes there summarized probably a year's worth of shows that we could potentially do on this subject. And I'm not going to be able to parse that, but you touched on so many areas that are very interesting to me and to a lot of folks that listen to this show.
So we need to stop and break it up into smaller chunks.
But I don't mean to edit or suppress anything that you're saying, but I want to deconstruct it a little bit, because when I did listen to a couple of your earlier interviews, it's a cliche term, but I was like blown away. I mean, there's just so much information there. And the edge that we have played on in this show, and it's an interesting edge to play, is kind of the intersection of skepticism and belief in these things. And too often it seems like, and I think you even alluded to this in your earlier talk, or part of what you were saying before, instead of that being an edge, we've turned it into this huge chasm where folks who have not shared this experience and don't so one, they haven't shared the experiential things that you have, and then two, intellectually, they haven't approached the subject in the same way that you have. They see no middle ground for coming together and exploring this issue. I'd say just something that you mentioned just in passing very early on is how it is viable to set up an experiment to test some of these things. So that's one of the things that we want to go into. But where I thought I might start in just kind of rolling that back is something that we almost touched on in the beginning, and that is, as a public intellectual and a person who has a variety of interests, you're obviously drawn to this because it seems like it's such a it seems like these topics that we're talking about are so fundamental. So fundamental to humanity, no matter what your political or religious stripe, no matter what field of academics you're in, why isn't there any kind of real discourse about this? Why, as soon as these topics are brought up, they're either kind of quickly swept under the rug, or there's the giggle factor in terms of exploring it seriously? Why can't we What inhibits this serious intellectual public debate about these topics that should be central to anyone who's interested in knowledge?
Well, I've been long interested in, and how successful I've been at, looking at how a consensus reality, you know, a mutually agreed to this is reality, like what psychologists would call reality testing. You kind of know the limits of it and the shape of it, and you can repeat it back to a clinician so they don't psychopathologize you. Oh, you're in the real world. You're in the real shared world, right? We're on the same page. That's called reality testing. Well, I'm interested in how consensus realities, that kind of conjoined agreed to reality at any one time, basically materialistic and media driven and what Noam Chomsky would call manufactured consent within it right now, that whole thing, how does a consensus reality get set up? How is it maintained? And especially, how is it possible, and if so, how would you do it, to transmute that consensus reality from within, by the very people who are the shareholders in that consensus reality? Because if the consensus reality is a pooled minute-by-minute input of our psychoenergetic systems and our belief systems and our, as well as our behaviors, then we're holding it still. There's a homeostasis to that consensus reality. And if you're a change agent like I am, or if you're sworn and you pray for guidance and help and to be kept clear and clean about it, you really want to make a difference. You want to, like Harry Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And since I was about 12, I was saying, please, Lord, put me in the heat of the kitchen. Put me closest to the stove. I want to be part of this change. I want to be born into these interesting times, as the Chinese would curse you with. And so I'm here. And so I'm fascinated by, is it possible to transmute consensus reality from within? Now we know, with the Sheldrakean fields and hundredth monkeys cliche, and also with Maharishi effect, and with the notion of the pair lab at Princeton and affecting random event generators away from chance as a function of mass events or pooled consciousness, intentionality. And there's a whole set of interrelated things that support the fact that, yes, if you could get the old telephone tree go, whatever the thing is, and just say, okay, boys and girls in this world, at least those of you that have an ear to hear, at Greenwich Mean Time, blah, 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 clock, next, blah, 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 let's target the thing. Let's all put our consciousnesses together and come from the same place, holding the same intention. And according to the Maharishi, you only need 0.1% or whatever the hell it is, and you can actually bring about that kind of change. So I'm a student of actually not just sitting here like a victim being slowly boiled like a frog in a stuck and constrained and stultified consensus reality, when I'm out of the box of it, but I'm in the world but not of it, and many of my friends are in the same boat. I'm hardly alone. But what do you do? It's kind of, what do you do? And so I look at things like channeling, and I say, it's possible to pull things through aerated air holes or poke some holes in the skin encapsulated ego or the hermetically sealed kind of thing and get more information and guidance and ideas, especially if there's a heartfelt connection to be a service to other, to really help the system and those in it, not just yourself. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things I bring to this interdisciplinary effort is, in my own part, is how can I make a difference, how can I beneficially make a difference to the system? Channeling is a way to self-transcend the system or to breathe some fresher air into the box. And then I train clinical psychologists for a living, part of what I've done the past 34 years, especially the past 10. And what I've learned from the clinical domain, the abnormal psych domain, as well as the cognitive psych domain, the cognitive science domain, is that we're lazy. We don't want to change. Homeostasis and all the autoimmune system metaphors of it, or whatever. How we maintain the way we are, and it's easier to do that, or we don't really know how not to. And change is hard. Very often we will not change within ourselves, let alone conjointly as group systems, unless something like the bank break meltdown or something landing on the White House lawn, or you know whatever my friend John Peterson, the futurist, calls wild cards. Out of the blue wild cards that might come in out of left field, hit upside the head this homeostatic stuckness and help it learn and grow. So a clinician sits with a client one-on-one and thinks, how can I get them unstuck from their own baggage and their own limitations and their own somnolism and their own defense mechanisms to try to get some growth and change? And you can say that of the whole consensus reality. You sure as hell can say it of the scientific and academic community. I mean, I've been in there for 34 years now, and I've never found a place with not having what I was promised it would have: intellectual curiosity, open-mindedness, tolerance, wanting to learn and accommodate from new things. No.
Hey, you know, let's take that and look through the clinician's view who you're training and look through that lens that you just said. How has it changed in the last 20 years? How is it still stuck? How is the perspective that you're able to bring to the future clinicians that come under your tutelage, what is the difference in the perspective you give them than they might receive if they were at standard U?
Well, first of all, I put things like channeling or psychic abilities, or altered consciousness work or altered states of consciousness, I put it all under a much more user-friendly, less threatening, garden variety set of variables or characteristics or abilities that we can all identify with, and nobody can say that ain't me at all. No, I can't draw. I can't make a tree look like a tree when I paint. I can't act. I can't. I'm not a poet. They'll come up with that stuff. But the 8 years I was at Rutgers and pyramiding down, working with hundreds of graduate students, we'll go field test the stuff we were talking about and bring it back and say that worked, that didn't. That was true to people out there. It isn't. We were really kept honest by it. And what happened was that I saw the arts and creativity and intuition and inspiration and imagination and as being the royal road to that human potential that is part of the same context within which the more scary or estranging or threatening psychic and an anomalous and miraculous or you know the devil's work or whatever the hell it might be construed as it allows you to get your foot in the door, kind of get the horse inside the gates and then release some time release capsules and trouble their sleep a little bit without seeming to be proselytizing or pushy.
So, and we can explore from the creative perspective, and I think there's plenty of examples. You know, you might be familiar, I'm sure you are, but with Stephen Schwartz in his recent book, Opening to the Infinite, and I think he does a great job of kind of chronicling how that creative genius touches and intersects with this connection with an infinite that we can't really totally get our arms around. So take that creative realm and then move that to the clinician's chair and intuition. So are you then using these ideas of intuition and as a means to make people more comfortable with the idea of the role that channeling and mediumship might play?
Yes, a larger insight, larger access of information and insight and energy and understanding and guidance even. And that it is, I would see it as self-transcending. We never thought of things like that. But when there I am 12 years old as a little artist poet thinking, what the hell's going on here? this is mysterious. It's wonderful. I'm in awe of all of it. But then I would go, you didn't often find creative people or people getting their PhDs in English literature or art history really getting into the creative process that way as much. And then I found people in the psychology realm, like Howard Gardner and Mahatma Csikszentmihalyi and many others, who were felt they were on the outside looking in at the creative process. Felt, well, I'm not really that, but I like to study, you know, geniuses and uh-huh. and people who really are the case of it. Maybe we can learn from them. This is positive psychology, really,
right.
Where we learn from not the damaged goods of our fellow beings, but from them on a very good hair day of being a human being, and see, gee, could I go there? Could I get have a little better quality of life? Could I be a little smarter? Could I be a little more self-fulfilled? And of course you can. So I focused at Rutgers those 8 years in this program I ran in how to make accessible these realms that could, in the extreme, be considered off-putting or threatening because you begin to then label them as psychism or metaphysics or, you know, don't be so open-minded your brains fall out and I'm not going to let that happen so you stay more tightly wrapped.
Right. Fascinating. Again, a lot of jumping off points there, but let me take a couple. A couple weeks ago, I had an opportunity to interview Dr. Carol Tarvis, who wrote the book Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And she really is coming at things from a very skeptical perspective, and we had an interesting dialogue. But the point that she makes is, of course, from the book, and you probably know the author, I forget, but When Prophecy Fails.
Festinger.
Festinger. Yeah. So it's really based on that research, and what that would suggest, and I've found this with my dealing with skeptics, is that kind of thing where they'll reach the edge and they'll start entering into some kind of dialogue and some kind of interaction with the anomalous information. But then, just as is predicted in When Prophecy Fails, they wind up incorporating that in by strengthening their belief and coming around to doing it that way too. So that leads to this question. What works? That's the question. And also, is it fair to kind of categorize and group and label? And of course it isn't. But there's dogmatic skeptics who are going to be totally closed. And there's these people in the middle. And then there's the closet believers who are in an academia or some kind of institution that really they've learned how to play the game and can't even venture out. Do you want to touch on a couple of those topics?
Well, the last part of that, no, it's not fair. And if you're someone like myself, and maybe yourself too, you've learned from experience what it feels like, to be in that skin when somebody does it to you. It's like all you people, you know, all you black skin, all you white skin, all you this, you that, you're that way. Here's the generalization I make about you, the one size fits all. And you say, wait a minute, I'm an individual. I'm not that. My first wife was a strong feminist, I mean, radical separatist feminist. And she and her posse, her sisters, they would just crucify me as just one of, you're all alike. You men, you're a man. I said, wait a minute, I'm not, there's something, I'm a unique individual. So if you've had that happen to you, if you've experienced isms, you know, racism, ageism, sexism, whatever it is, and also the intellectual domains of it, the beliefism, you know, the paradigmism of it from someone else's paradigm, then I got to the point that I wouldn't want to do it to anybody else. If I could feel bad that way, I don't want to make someone else feel bad that way. Why just multiply the damn thing? So I'm going to pull my punch. I'm going to hold my tongue if I can and do unto others as I wish had been done unto me, which usually was not. So that's my little story about having learned on the job of life. But what works, one of the things that works, I think, I'm looking for things that are seem innocuous, that seem non-threatening, that are likely to not estrange, like using terms, you know, complementary and alternative medicine. You know, we've settled on terms, some of these terms like this, and I've been in the kind of the kitchen heat of some of that with people who are kind of coming up with some of these things like alternative medicine and things like that, that where you choose terms that don't further estrange or antagonize, you know, this kind of political situation, this loyal opposition thing. This is this politics of consciousness again, that we're all voting each moment with usually almost totally unconsciously, but we're co-constituting.
You know, though, hold on, I just have to interject because that just doesn't feel right to me. And you were mentioning feelings before, and I want to go there for just a minute. And, you know, mm-hmm. I did back to this interview with Dr. Tarvis, and we kind of got into it on that. And the turning point or the fulcrum point was really Freud, you know. And I said, okay, but you seem to be on one hand kind of owning up to just what a complete charlatan and how discredited all his ideas would be if they were in modern day academia. We would just certainly just cast them all out, and yet we carry all this baggage with us. And you seem to a certain extent, I'm talking to Dr. Tarvis now, be kind of carrying that baggage along because it's useful to a certain community that you talk to, and that you would be kind of, it'd be too off-putting to say, well, really, let's all just kind of own up to this. You know, and she said, well, you know, that's kind of how you have to do it. We have to kind of meet people where they are, and we have to, and you're kind of saying the same thing. And I guess I feel like, isn't the promise of science that if we do come with a heart that is open and well-meaning, can't we just get down to the facts? Can't we get down to the data? Can't we always just come back to, wait, let's find a way with this beautiful gift we've been given, the scientific method, to design and experiment and collaborate and let the data drive where we go, rather than try and PC massage the words so that you'll listen to me?
Well, first of all, although I do my fair share of the PCing and the massaging of the words and the discreet diplomatic choice of things, at the same time, I am, from feedback I've gotten, I am an anomaly. And especially when you plunk me down in the middle of academia or a bunch of professors, I am anomalous. When my mouth opens, it's relatively anomalous stuff. So I'm already doing damage or planting seeds or destabilizing or de-automatizing, you know, an expectation. I'm violating expectations. I'm not what it
is. Oh, yeah.
You know, so in other
yeah,
words,
I agree with that. Yeah.
I'm doing the work. I'm doing the work, but not in an overt way that allows them to go get their guns. You know, and kind of grab a knife and shivvy with it, or just you'll never do lunch in this town again, and okay, that's the last conference you ever go to, or whatever it could be, to just keep this stuff minimized so I can stay non-lucid rather than lucid. And so if you want to, you know, in lucid dream research, lucid dream tends to emerge from a non-lucid dream as a function of an anomaly experience in the non-lucid dream. Where you say, wait a minute, am I dreaming? But this shouldn't be happening. You're floating toward the ceiling. Wait, have I been dreaming up until now? That kind of thing. And so if the analogy is regular dreaming is the lucid dreaming, as something like regular awakeness is the something like lucid awakeness, or in a shared dream, then what is our role or our function? What Rollo May, the psychologist, called the courage to create, one of his titles. Do we have the courage to, and I think I have this reputation to a certain extent, to stand forth and be unusual or different or an outsider or anomalous or speak from places that you it's not just preaching to each other's choir, and it's destabilizing, and it is a necessary prerequisite to altering consciousness and to growth and change, whether you're talking clinically or cognitively. And so in that sense, what works for me is to take my own idiosyncratic approach, which tickles people open or leaves them different than I left them, but they didn't even quite know what hit them, because nothing hit them hard. It was maybe a more feminine view, but it's also postmodern. So I can actually say, let's talk about postmodernism. Do you believe there is one monolithic, modernistic, one-size-fits-all explanation of things? Discord reductionism, let's say. And they say, yes, that's science. That's the only thing you may trust. And I say, well, let's talk about that. And what I'm trying to do is to tickle at the edges of the erodibility or the vulnerability of this totally inclusive quality of physical reductionism. It doesn't work anymore, and there's contraindicating things for it. So I'll take tacks like that, for example. But also just someone in the presence of the way my mind works, which is not everybody, half of my students here don't like the way my mind works. You know, they wouldn't recommend me as a teacher to somebody else because they can't follow me. I'm not linear. I'm multi-leveled. And I'm also talking more to their higher self a bit or something like that, and they don't even want to own up to that that's there. Is this on the test? Is this on the test? Am I going to get a B?
Yes, it's on the test, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've lived with that for 34 years. Now, that's not to say that the other half of the people aren't saying, give me more. Can I pull an all-nighter with you? There's that, too. But let's look at the fact that the system is run kind of top-down by the more tightly wrapped, the ones that are still, guarding the gate of the reigning scientific paradigm with this dominant physical reductionism and the other kind of ancillary things that are related to it. Now, I'm the loyal opposition in the politics of consciousness. I'm sworn to get people to stop voting for that party, for that paradigm coming from that place, and more vote from a more modified, you know, more moderate, let's say, maybe even moving toward a more liberal place or a more idealist place or something. So by doing, we could actually, you know, where people are coming from, co-constitute a different consensus reality, or at least patches of us and rival pockets of consensus realities. And we're not all stuck in the same, being boiled alive in the one main one, which is still dominated by a scientific paradigm. So in that sense, the artist in me, not the scientist, not the scholar, not the debate team guy, because I'm not much good at that either, but the Dionysian, idiosyncratic, moving target, multi-leveled channeling, I guess you could say, at least of the universal through me or my own higher self, that gets in there and the spirit moves me and I do what seems to be needed in the situation to affect change, even though it's very subtle. And people come back 6 months later and say, you know, when I heard you give that talk, I thought you were full. And I could put in all my pigeonholes, all the stuff that was coming up there. But now I'm coming back to you because something's different. I feel different. It's like, you know, in the clinical domain, you know, change happens, but maybe not until it has to happen. I'm a cockeyed optimist that we can appeal to people, to the voters, to the existential, transpersonal, you know, side of the voter in all of us. I believe that. And certainly, if you do your homework enough and you give positive regard to the other at the same time, you don't want to leave it the way you found it. And it isn't okay the way it is. And it ain't the best of all possible work. I'm talking about the righteous warrior right now. No, damn it, I don't want to let it the way it is. I don't want to just coddle and let them go on the way they were because they've done a lot of damage to me. I'm hurt. I'm damaged goods. I've been traumatized by people like that. And I don't want to traumatize them in turn, but, you know, I can, at the end of the day, I can lie in bed kind of a little warm, fuzzy feeling. But I actually got to that person, you know. Now, do I get to everybody? No, I don't. But I'm not, you know, I'm not in some kind of delusion of grandeur situation. I'm the only one walking around whose shoulders that job is. There's so many people kind of waking up to these things, and then they begin to have the courage to create. It says to open their mouth and be slightly anomalous to the more closed people around them, and you begin to think, shit, maybe the consensus reality is not as predictably closed and just like me as I used to be as I thought it was. And then, of course, the scientists that come out of the closet is very important. And it's almost like you wait to the professor emeritus stage when they have the courage to create, the courage to stand forth and speak, because you can always be gotten earlier before the pre-professor emeritus stage. Like Bill Tiller was very courageous and got taken.
But, I think that's changing, too. I mean, I can agree with you on a number of accounts. I mean, one, I certainly think that, you know, it's a desperate situation to find yourself in terms of having a different view of things and where you want things to go. And in the end, you just have to put your shoulder behind that rock and, you know, like Sisyphus, your fellow Sisyphinians, if that's a word, you know, just push that darn thing up the hill and not really worry too much about it. And by the same token, I'm a cockeyed optimist like you are too. And I certainly respect and honor the artist and the poet in you, because I think that's such a wonderful way to kind of dance with this information. I come at it, I think, from a different perspective, in just a tiny way, but more as a computer guy and as a former businessman who was forced to be strictly pragmatic and goal oriented.
Yes.
And one of the things that I see that is maybe a crack of light is this technology that we're using right now, because the other way around that institution that has and is holding on to the power because it's self-perpetuating in its the way that it works is that we can go around it, you know, with science and you know, we started a little something called open source science, which the idea of taking the same open source technologies that disintermediates so many of the institutions in every other area of our life, like the internet has done, and say, can we disintermediate the institutions from science? Can we get the right minds together to devise appropriate protocols, appropriate designed experiments? And then can we run those experiments and use the communication vehicle that has become the internet as a way to make that much more efficient? And in the end, can we generate results that help move the dialogue along for those folks who need that kind of empirical evidence? And I think that's a lot of people to one extent or another. So I guess I kind of balance the two. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on on some of those topics and how we might create another body of empirical evidence and do it faster and better than we could ever hope to do inside of academia.
Right. I completely agree with you. How can media be used? We'd all like to be Bill Moyers. You know, we'd all like to do I've worked a number of times with people where the common denominator was, and none of it came to fruition, we wanted to have a Nova show. We wanted to get a gig, an hour on Nova, you know, that would be PBS nationally distributed. And all kinds of things like survival of physical death, or extraterrestrials, or electronic voice communication, where you're actually getting voices from the dead, supposedly, that is actually recorded, there's no medium involved, and stuff like that. But why it doesn't come to fruition? Maybe the timing isn't right, maybe the consensus reality, the energies.
But John, I mean, the other part of that, in the first part of that, you kind of brought this up, the whole thing is changing. Because you started out talking about YouTube, you know? I think the whole idea of an ABC one-hour special is quickly becoming irrelevant.
Okay, fine.
And
I agree. Yep.
I think in that same way where, you know, the dissemination of information, which we're calling media, is undergoing this just kind of rapid turnaround where your presentation on YouTube, if it's successful at all within a short period of time, is going to reach a larger, more targeted audience than anything on the Discovery Channel that'll run in the next year. And that's just the way that it is.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that same kind of transition is coming in science, where a scientific experiment properly done on the internet with the proper controls, with the proper consultation from the right representatives with the right credentials,
yes. Yes.
If that won't in the same way kind of revolutionize science, and we can then say, you know, I don't give a crap what research you've done and what peer-reviewed process you've done.
Yeah.
Here it is for everyone to see, and, you know, here's the momentum behind this. And I don't have a good example at this point to point to of that happening, but that seems to me to be just around the corner.
Yes, yes. And thank you very much for pointing out to me that I was backsliding into kind of an earlier generational way of thinking about a more modernist view of reaching people and information conveyance like primetime TV or something. But I'm sort of new to this other side. I'm not quite even sure what a podcast is. I know what a website is now, but I thought I was going to add new things to it each week and kind of talk to people, whoever checks in, and they might start to get in the habit of that. Well, that's already existing. It's called something different. It's not your website necessarily. So I'm just admitting that I'm pretty naive about a lot of these things, but everything you said makes all the sense in the world to me. Yes, that's the direction things are going. That's where I'd like to put my eggs in the basket of. That's what I put my bread on the waters of, not a publishing house, although I just sent a proposal off to Random House. So the point is that I agree, and let me jump to a couple of things. Dick Bierman. Okay, now he's not the only one, but he really kind of pioneered. Well, I was over there many years ago for an oral defense for dissertation of a friend of mine, where he got his PhD from University of Utrecht in Parapsych, one of the few places in the world that can do that, 500-year-old institution. And so we were having supper at Bierman's place, and after supper we go over in a study. We were staying with him, and he gets on a computer and he shows us an ongoing running experiment where people are trying to do a kind of an aimed intentionality or PK to affect the pattern of pedestrians walking across an intersection area where there's a constantly going good camera that's going on.
Man.
And that he became one of many nodes in that. And to brainstorm this, let alone to see who's already tried inventing that wheel, there's more and more people are actually doing that. And it would be nice, we don't need a journal, but we need some kind of way to tell it, to remind each other who's doing that and who the new kid on the block is with it and how it begins to accrue together. So we have a conference on it, we have a teleconference. How do we share that? How do we then turn to the more establishment community and say, here's what we're doing in our subculture?
You know, that's such an interesting thought, because as you were talking about enabling science with the technology, I think your mind can immediately go to two ways. And one is, what are the unique opportunities the technology kind of creates, which is, gosh, there's just as many as we could probably think here in a half hour. We'd probably have more than we could do in a lifetime. And then there's also just all the just improving through technology, more or less routine or experiments that are more traditional. And I think that just using the internet and the other computer technologies as an enabling and expediting kind of a tool, which is a little bit of what we found here too. I was just going to say, John, and you've been extremely generous with your time, but there was something that you talked about a few minutes ago that I wanted to kind of bring up as maybe the last topic we talk about today. And I want to get in and talk about spirituality a little bit. And I didn't want to leave that alone because I think that, again, you just need to be so credited with being brave enough to even include the word God, you know, and just to say my lifelong desire to understand the ultimate secrets of the universe, including how God works and how John Klimo is God in localized, individualized, vastly stepped down form. And I think that's a wonderful quote, and I don't know why it has to be so brave.
True for all of us, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and I don't know why it has to be so brave for a public intellectual to say that, but it is, and we have to acknowledge that. You know, there was an analogy you brought back. You were talking about kind of one-to-many, Sermon on the Mount, speaking to many, and you're saying, you know, hey, maybe that model has passed. And I think you were alluding to that. At least that's where I took it, because I think that model has passed, and I think that we've seen that also in spirituality, and I saw a recent Pew survey of Americans, and you can read a lot into that depending on whether you're conservative or whether you're liberal. But what jumped out at me was how many folks are kind of rolling their own spirituality. And when they do, they're no longer ascribing to this kind of hierarchical model, and they're more seeing this idea of this, as you said, stepped down God that is in all of us. And do you think that's a trend? And maybe just speak for a minute about what that's all about.
Oh yes, absolutely. It's a trend. It's part of the, I like Taylor de Chardin, the Jesuit scientist, priest's notion of this tropism, this teleological tropism toward within the noosphere, or the kind of spirit consciousness envelope of our species and our planet. There's this movement, this evolutionary movement, toward the omega point, which he calls Christ consciousness. You could insert other things instead, but something like that. And you know, people like Terence McKenna, you know, kind of stepped it up sooner to these Mayan calendar kind of things. And when the things have to go ballistically nonlinear and kind of quantum coherent out of prior quantum incoherence, decoherence. But I absolutely believe that. That's where the faith, because it's equipotentially in each of us human beings. We're a node of that God potentiality and being in consciousness. And it's dormant, it's somnolistic, it's whatever, it's dissociated, it's repressed, it's not reinforced. It's not modeled much by people who would stand forth and say, come join me. You know, and Christ said that. But we need Christ today that are saying it, essentially, who are not off-putting, are like, gee, I could never be like that. Sure you can. Yeah, I believe that. So the participatory thing, again, yes, I absolutely believe that. It is a spiritual movement. It's a revolution. Stan Grof and his wife, you know, coined the term spiritual emergence and spiritual emergency. And, you know, I part of what I do clinically is I'm not a clinician, technically, but I help people having these emergences, these spontaneous, you know, the Protestant wing of it, where it's not religion anymore. They're either lapsed from that or they never had that. But they're trying to cobble together and find and home in on and be drawn toward their own spiritual connectedness and so on. And this means the world to me. And I've been involved with this confluence of science and spirituality, you know, for decades now. And there have been times that I've ached to have more of a platform or a talking stick or a way to talk to other people about it and have them talk about it. But part of the shyness of the introversion is I'm not very good at pitching that. I have no agents or anything like that. But the point is that I see that so central to everything. The spirituality is central to everything. Now, on the website, I've taken an attack of a philosophical idealism, which sounds kind of dry, but it just means that everything is consciousness. But not only that, Hegel, the philosopher, said it's spirit. Everything is spirit with a capital S, or absolute spirit. And that's just another way of talking about Vedantic or Vedic science, that it's all a consciousness field. It's a living being. It's got a heart, too. So that's my spirituality, and I see more and more people kind of awakening out of the somnolism toward that, each in their own respective way. I just want to encourage it, not knowing where it's going to, what shape it's going to take with them, but and model my version of it and say that won't be your way. That happened to be my way, and that's really the main work that I see myself doing from here forward.
Well, Dr. John Klimo, it's been extremely, extremely interesting, just wonderful speaking with you. I appreciate you taking so much time.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. And I'm maybe this is the old paradigm, but I'm someone like me is very dependent upon someone like you and your situation and your setup and your vehicles to do anything other than talk to myself.
Well, I think you've also planted a seed in Dinner with Andre. I'm going to go check the I'm going to go check the availability of that domain name, you know, because it's a good resting place to kind of germinate that idea of, can there be a place where we can invite certain people to come together and share in a dialogue that's directed and at the same time let loose to kind of run wherever it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'd love to follow up with you more about any ideas you might have on a new paradigm for how to move science outside of the system and at the same time engage the system. You know, because as you were talking about that, the model that sprang to mind is that, you know, if the internet and these other technologies enable science to sprout over here, that maybe the intersection is not with the folks who hold the power in a traditional way, but that, as you mentioned it at your university and at every university, they're also saying, how can I move to the internet? How can I disseminate this information differently? And maybe the meeting point is up at a different level if you just do it and then come back around and say, hey, I've done this over here. Would you like the opportunity to kind of join in and direct where it goes in the future? I think that sometimes works a little bit better, you know, than to try and... It's easier to get forgiveness than permission,
yes,
you know.
Yes. Count me in, you know, as a fellow player in these things, we move ahead.
Great. Well, we'll be sure to do that. Well, thanks again. Okay. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Alex, for the opportunity.
Thanks again to Dr. John Klimo for joining us today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about the show or any of our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website. That's SKEPTIKO.com. You find links to all our previous shows, our forum, an email link for me where you can drop me a note, and all sorts of other good stuff. Well, that's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.